support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries, dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann this week. Sometimes it seems that nearly every day when you open the newspaper or look online or flip on the radio, there's a new study telling you that supplement or drug is bad or good for you now. And that the same seems to be true for foods. Eggs are good, protein, eggs, and then eggs are bad because of cholesterol. Then another study comes out and says they're good again. Coffee, milk, beef, the list goes on and on and on. Here to tell us about the pitfalls of taking health research at face value is Dr. Richard Gunderman. He's a professor of medicine at Indiana University. Dr. Gunderman, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks, Steve. It's nice to be with you.
And listeners, give us a call. Let us know if you've ever changed your diet or supplements because of a study, and did you end up regretting it? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. You can also email the show, allsides@wosu.org. You can find us on Facebook, and you can tweet at WOSU All Sides. Dr. Gunderman, let's dive right into this. In a recent piece in The Atlantic titled How Health Research Misdirects Us, you wrote, quote, "The mere fact that biomedical researchers can find a statistically significant relationship between good health and a particular drug, supplement, dietary modification, or medical device does not, in fact, establish that it's healthful." Expand on that. Why is that?
Well, for several reasons, Steve. One is that if you have a drug, let's say, that has no effect, but you get enough people to test it, to run clinical trials on that drug, if you do enough trials, statistically speaking, some of those are likely to show positive results. A sort of intuitive example of that would be if I asked you to flip a coin four times. The odds of coming up heads all four times would be about 1 in 16. But on the other hand, if we asked 100 people to flip a coin four times, it wouldn't be a surprise at all if a few of those people got heads four times in a row. So that doesn't mean that that's a likely event. But if we only report those people who got heads four times, it might lead us to assume that probability is higher than it really is.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the pitfalls of taking health research at face value. On the line with us is Dr. Richard Gunderman, a professor at Indiana University. In that same piece for The Atlantic, you cite the example of vitamin E. And that's interesting because there was a recent study here released at OSU. It found that vitamin E can help prevent cancer, but that the supplements in the health food source are not the right type or dosage for this effect, and this back and forth, it can be kind of exhausting, hard for health-conscious consumers to be informed.
You're right about that, Steve. It's a bewildering array of different findings reported, as you say, almost on a daily basis, and it is hard for practicing physicians and scientists, let alone members of the general public, to keep a handle on what's happening. But as you indicate, in the case of vitamin E, in fact, vitamin E is not a single substance. It's a group of several fat-soluble compounds that are clearly necessary for good health. If you have no vitamin E in your diet, you're in big trouble. But that of itself doesn't necessarily prove that taking large amounts of vitamin E, you know, big doses of vitamin E tablets, is necessarily good for you. And in fact, let's suppose that vitamin E really does improve your serum lipid profile. Let's say that it really does lower your cholesterol, for example. Even if that's true, that doesn't mean that overall taking those vitamin E supplements would be good for you. We have, I mentioned in the article, we have some substances that are superb at lowering blood pressure. There are some drugs that if people take them, lower the blood pressure of every single person. Nobody has hypertension if they take those drugs. But, of course, some of those drugs might be poisons. You take a poison, it's going to lower your blood pressure. So that drug is extremely effective in lowering blood pressure, but of course it's also ending the lives of people who take it. Well, that's a particularly extreme example, but it highlights a very important point, that if we look at just one narrow endpoint, like blood pressure or serum lipids, things like cholesterol in your blood, or the amount of inflammation in your joints, we might say, boy, this drug is effective at reducing inflammation or lowering cholesterol. But when in fact patients take it, it may turn out to be a net detriment. In other words, to be more harmful because it has other effects beyond the one we're studying.
What's the most glaring example of contradictory research that you've seen, or maybe the most dated research that you've seen that just proposed something outlandish that was later proven to be untrue, or at least partially untrue?
Well, one of the most extreme examples I can think of was in the early part of the 20th century. There was a very highly regarded physician who was eventually lost his medical license, but he built a very thriving medical practice, restoring virility for his male patients, basically by transplanting the testicles of sheep and goats, I guess it was goats, into their scrotums. Now, to us, that sounds, how could anybody ever think that was going to restore male virility? But in fact, he may have believed it. Certainly some of his patients believed it. And many of those patients reported a very beneficial effect from that procedure. But you know, by our lights today, that just doesn't make any sense. And one reason a drug or procedure might produce a beneficial effect, at least in the eyes of a patient who's taking it, is what we call the placebo effect. The word placebo, of course, comes from the Latin, meaning I will please. If you give me a little purple pill that I sincerely believe is going to relieve my pain or lift my mood, it's quite possible that I'll report a beneficial effect from taking that pill, even though, you know, its contents are only sugar or salt.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller on the line, Lee from Columbus, with a question. Lee, go ahead.
Yes, I recently read about some warnings on Zithromax causing heart problems. And that's a fairly popular drug for upper respiratory infections and things like that. I just wonder what your take was on that study.
Yeah, I would prefer not to comment on any particular drug just because the research involved is so complex and the patients taking it are so different from each other, it's hard to generalize too broadly. But I will say this, sometimes drugs that appear to be beneficial when tried on small groups of people, then when given to large groups, turn out to have side effects or harmful effects that we couldn't have anticipated when we tested them on small groups of people. And you'll see, you know, sometimes conflicting reports in the popular press or the medical literature around the effects of certain drugs.
Lee, sorry, I wish we could get to your particular... Sorry, Lee had a rough phone line there. Had to drop you. We're speaking with Dr. Gunderman from the Professor of Medicine at the University of Indiana. Please send your health questions, send your questions or concerns about contradictory health studies. Call us 614-292-8513. And Dr. Gunderman, you talked about how small sample sizes can really change the results of a study. Is this ever intentional, or is it usually intentional? Does it have to do with the pressure to publish research?
That's a terrific question. And I want to say up front that I work elbow to elbow with a lot of scientists and physicians who are doing very important medical research. And these are among the people in the world I admire the most. Mm-hmm. I mean, we attract just some not only extremely bright, but some really ethical and admirable people to medicine and biomedical research. I don't want to say for a second that I think biomedical scientists are bad people or are trying to perpetrate a fraud on the American public or their patients. But those of us in medicine and biomedical science, we're also human beings. And, you know, we operate with biases. If I'm doing research, I happen to be a pediatric radiologist. If I'm doing research in the field of pediatric radiology, I have a natural bias toward wanting to prove something important, to demonstrate some important effect, right? To prove that some new device I'm testing or some new drug I'm testing is really going to be effective. And those biases, though unintended and perhaps even unrecognized by those of us doing the research, can sometimes very much color the results we get. And we just have to be mindful of that. And that's one reason we try to have a rigorous system of what's often called peer review. That is, if I perform an experiment or conduct a clinical trial, I submit those results to a professional meeting or a journal, and then some of my peers look at those results critically and ask themselves, has he in fact demonstrated that there's a real beneficial effect here, or could these results be biased or contaminated in some way? And that's a good system, but it is not a perfect system. And sometimes we report results that in retrospect turn out not to be warranted.
And are there consequences for that? Are there consequences for the people who publish this research, who do this research that tends out to be false? You know, if I report a false story, I likely get in trouble with my news director. Is there a similar system in place for research?
Well, there's the answer is both yes and no. It's no in the sense that there's no single national body that reviews all biomedical research and gives it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And there's even less attention to research published 10 or 20 years ago because we're all trying to be on the cutting edge. So we tend not to go back and repeat experiments that might have been done a decade or two ago. But on the other hand, if I report results that are subsequently refuted, shown to be invalid by colleagues, that's certainly not going to advance my career. And, you know, in most of those cases, that's going to be a matter of, a statistical fluke or something about my methodology that was problematic. But, you know, there are some cases, happily, we think a very low number of cases, where there's actually scientific misconduct. And there have been some celebrated cases where scientists and physicians actually fabricated results. It's not, you know, that the method they used in collecting data was flawed. It's that in some cases, people made up data, let's say, to advance their careers. And that is really dangerous. There's the self-corrective mechanism of science works pretty well as long as everybody's on the up and up and doing their best, you know, to collect data and analyze data and report data in a responsible fashion. But if there's a rogue individual who's just making things up, that's a quite different kind of problem.
And we hear in the media, a story about a new, important, seemingly groundbreaking study is great stuff. We really love doing stories about important studies. How much of the blame falls on the media for jumping at these studies and putting them over their airwaves, and then sometimes they turn out to be not true or to at least be misleading?
Steve, I admire you for posing that question. One of the themes of our conversation so far is our ability to be self-critical. Mm-hmm. And just like physicians and scientists need to be self-critical, we need the popular press, the news media, to be self-critical as well. And let's face it, if I need to move copies of my weekly news magazine or my daily newspaper or attract listeners to my radio program, it's helpful to be able to report exciting new positive results, you know, about a drug that's going to help us lose weight or lift our moods or help us live longer. That's big news that we're all interested in. But there is a kind of bias there toward reporting positive results. New things, because they're on the cutting edge, that's what we mean by news, right? Something right. That's new. Well, it's only new for 24 hours or 48 hours or for a week, and it may in fact require additional years of study before we can rigorously test that finding. And if it turns out that it's not beneficial or not nearly as beneficial as we thought, those results are likely to get much less attention in the news media. Negative results just aren't as interesting. No. You know, to most of us, they just don't seem as newsworthy.
No, that's definitely fair. We do have an email from Beth. She understands the concept of the placebo effect. Does your guest believe there's also an inverse if some patients are extremely skeptical about the efficacy of a prescribed medication and reluctant to take it? Is there a likelihood that it will not work for them?
I don't have scientific evidence to support what I'm about to say, but my own anecdotal experience is that the answer is yes. If somebody is very skeptical, very reluctant, harbors grave doubts about some procedure or new medication they're going to start, I think it tends to undermine the results. So if I, as a physician, say, I'm so sorry to hear about your terrible toothache, but I'm going to prescribe a drug here for pain relief, I could go about that one of two ways. I could say, you know, this drug is very effective. In fact, I took it, my wife took it, one of my kids took it. They felt so much better within an hour of taking this, and I'm confident it's going to help you. That's one way I could introduce it to you. The other way would be, I've got this drug here. They say it's effective for your kind of pain. I've actually never used it. Don't know anybody who's ever taken it. If I were you, I'd just try to tough it out mm-hmm. and not take any medicine. But if you want to, you can go ahead and take this. Well, you know, those are two very different ways of introducing a drug. And I personally think, and there's some pretty good evidence in the literature for thinking that this does powerfully affect how effective that medication is going to be for that patient. Now, this so-called placebo effect is more pronounced in things like pain control or perhaps elevating somebody's mood, right? A drug for depression. I don't want to suggest that the placebo effect is going to cure cancer, you know, or restore full brain function to somebody who's had a stroke. That's not the nature of it. But clearly, when it comes to things like pain or mood, just as examples, the placebo effect can be very, very powerful. And I would put myself in a group of physicians who say, we've got to make sure that we don't let new drugs come to market that are only producing a benefit because of the placebo effect, because patients believe they're going to mm-hmm. be effective. We don't want to spend millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars on a drug that's only effective as a placebo. But on the other hand, if I believe a drug is going to help my patient or a procedure is going to benefit my patient, I want to take full advantage of the placebo effect
sure.
because I want to do as much as I can for my patient and help this person feel better as soon as possible.
Well, Dr. Gunderman-Osh, we had more time to talk about it, but we are simply out of time for this segment. Excuse me. Dr. Richard Gunderman is a professor of medicine at Indiana University, and he recently wrote an article titled How Health Research Misdirects Us that was in the Atlantic magazine. Dr. Gunderman, thanks again for your time this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
And when we return, how your mood may be able to boost your brain power. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
Thanks for joining us today on 89.7 NPR News. A region of central Idaho is the largest wilderness area in the lower 48 states, with endless rugged mountains, wild rivers, and deep canyons. Tonight on WOSU-TV, venture into the wilderness and find out why a young couple chose this area for their year-long honeymoon. Watch Nature, River of No Return. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. And it's 40 degrees with some clouds, a high near 43 today, partly cloudy tonight, a low of 29. Support for WOSU comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the spring edition, available now, can be found at ediblecolumbus.com. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann this week. The cognitive decline associated with aging is a growing concern for all of us as people, on average, are living longer. Researchers are looking for ways to combat the loss of mental abilities, and it's sometimes suggested that diet and doing puzzles can help, and recent research has shown being in a positive mood may also affect brain function. Joining us now to discuss mood in the brain is Dr. Ellen Peters, a professor of psychology at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve.
Other research has shown that being in a good mood can boost the cognitive abilities of young people. And before we get into your research specifically, explain how that is, how cognitive ability and mood are often intertwined.
Cognitive ability and mood can be intertwined because of what positive mood can do to the brain. When someone becomes in a more positive mood, it's thought to release a chemical in the brain called a neurotransmitter, and it's a chemical called dopamine. And it's supposed to release dopamine into areas of the brain that are involved in cognitive kinds of things. And because of that increased chemical in the brain, we get better at certain cognitive things.
So your experiment specifically was designed to see if the same effect could be found in older people. So how did you put the test subjects in a good mood, and how did you do this research?
Yeah, so we it was actually a master's project of a student of mine. And what we did, the original research looking at positive mood and improving things like creativity had used it's called a positive mood induction. So we induce a positive mood. And what the previous research had done is it had given people a bag of candy. And if you give someone a little gift, just a little gift, like a little bag of candy, a little, an umbrella, just some little gift, it's been shown to have this really nice, robust effect on positive mood. It makes people just that little bit more happy.
Yeah, it makes you smile.
Yeah, exactly. It makes you smile, and it kind of makes you feel good inside a little bit. And it's those good feelings that then can have these surprising effects on other things that you do. In the particular task we did, we had a couple of things happen, though. We started off in some pilot tests giving that little bag of candy, but we quickly figured out with our older adults that about half of them were diabetic. And so what we ended up doing in the end is we gave them two bags of candy, one that had sugar in it and one that was sugar-free. And we said, feel free to eat both of them afterwards, or feel free to give one to somebody else. And so we did that as so those two bags of candy was the one of our first positive mood induction. And then we had them going through sort of a lengthy task where they could win and lose small amounts of money. And in that lengthy task, what we did to continue our positive mood induction is we had just little smiling suns around the outside of the experiment, and we had pre-tested those smiling suns to also be something that kind of makes you smile a little.
Mm-hmm. And so you've put them in a good mood.
Yep.
And how did their decision-making improve, or what was that part of the study?
Yeah, so in that part of the study, we used what's called an experiential task. We showed them decks of cards, and they originally knew nothing about the decks of cards. And we simply asked them to choose and to go ahead and accept a card off of a deck if they wanted to, and to reject it if they didn't want to. And they could differentiate the different decks of cards based on some geometric pattern that was on the back of the deck of the cards. And what's interesting is that what happens in tasks like that is that even though you know nothing at the beginning, when you pick a card, you win money or you lose money, and then you go on to the next deck, and you win. And let's say you choose that too, and you win money or you lose money. What's interesting is that over time, you start to get a sense of which are the good decks and which are the bad decks, and so people learn. And so over time, what happens by the end is that some people will end up choosing much better. They'll win a lot of money and they won't lose very much money, and some people won't choose as well. They may lose a lot of money or they won't win very much money.
So what's the hope of this study, or what's the practical effect or the end game? Is it that people should always be in good moods?
Yeah, probably not realistic, but it's a great idea. To me, one of the end effects of these is that sometimes in life we have very important decisions to make about things that we don't necessarily know much about at the moment or that we could know more about. And that particularly for somebody else, you can give that person a little gift, just a little shot of positive mood, and it'll help them to make better decisions in that moment. And so, for example, with my undergraduate students, when I teach courses in decision making, when it comes time for the final, I'll often give them each a little bag of candy right before they take the final. And the idea is you lift their positive mood a little bit, and it helps them to make better decisions on the final so that hopefully they do better.
I'm sure they like you a lot, too.
I like them, too. It works both ways.
Dr. Ellen Peters is a professor of psychology at Ohio State University. She's one of the authors of a new study that found mood can affect the memory and decision-making process in older people. If you have any questions for Dr. Peters or about cognitive abilities in general, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, the number to call, 614-292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. You can find the show on Facebook, and you can tweet at WOSU All Sides. In general, how does aging affect judgment and decision-making specifically? How does aging and judgment, how are they tied?
So they're actually tied in kind of a complex way. The way that we oftentimes think about aging is as a negative thing. We think about the cognitive declines that come with aging, and there are very robust cognitive declines that happen with aging. We slow down in how quickly we can think through things. Our working, how well we remember things gets a little less good. And that suggests that we're going to inevitably be worse decision makers. But that's not it. That's just sort of a simple story, and it's a negative story about aging. There are other processes that happen that change across our lifespans also, though. One thing that happens is that our experience accumulates. We get more wise. We've learned more over time, and that experience over time actually makes us better decision makers in those places where we have experience. Another thing that happens is that older adults, even though they have they do experience these cognitive declines, they also oftentimes know about it, and they can selectively choose when to use their cognitive ability and when not to.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so if there's a really important decision to be made, and the older adult recognizes that it's an important decision to be made, they can often bring their cognitive abilities to bear and end up making decisions in a very similar way to younger adults.
Yeah, they just really kind of tighten down and focus.
Exactly. They tighten down and focus. They selectively use their deliberative abilities. These people are not stupid by any means. And it's the idea is that they can make selective use of their capacity and of their wisdom, of course. There's also a third process that changes across the lifespan, and that has to do with emotional focus. As we get older, the evidence on this last one is a little less good, but as we get older, how much we focus on emotional things seems to increase relative to younger adults. And that ends up being important because things that we have emotional reactions to are oftentimes the things that are most important to us. And so if we're better able to focus on things that are emotional and therefore of the most importance to us, we often can make very good decisions as a result. And so aging has this really complex relationship with judgment and decision making.
And you say older people are able to kind of tighten down and focus and make decisions similar to young people. Are they unable to maintain that long-term focus? Is that why they do this?
I guess I'm not sure. Can you explain your question again? I didn't understand.
You said they are able to kind of hone in and focus in and make a really, really keen decisions when they need to, but they don't always. Does that tend to be because they're not able to maintain long-term focus?
I'm not sure it's really because they can't maintain long-term focus. It's although I guess you could argue that someone who's older might get tired, might get fatigued more easily. I think it has more to do with in these kind of situations where the decision is important or it's relevant to them in some way, they simply select to think harder about it. And when the situation becomes less important or doesn't seem as meaningful to them, they don't think as hard. They kind of relax back into their usual way of doing things.
We're speaking with Dr. Ellen Peters, a professor of psychology at Ohio State University and the author of a new study that found mood can affect the memory and decision-making process in older people. I do remember my dad always complaining about growing old, but can it improve your mood in any ways? You say that it can have negative effects on your memory, but when it comes to your mood, can it improve your mood?
It actually can. Yeah, older adults tend to be in more positive moods than younger adults. They're better able at regulating their emotions. compared to younger adults. And as a result of that, they tend to focus on the positive more and be in more positive moods.
Sure, that makes sense. We do have a caller, Jeff, calling from Westerville. Jeff, you're on the air.
Thanks. I had a question. I was very curious about the study, the doctor's methodology. Was the control group a neutral mood, and how could you establish that? Or did you also use a negative mood versus a positive mood to test the result?
Yeah, great question, Jeff. You clearly understand science. So we had two groups in this particular study, and what we chose to do was a positive mood group and a neutral mood group. We didn't look at a negative mood group at all because we were interested in that difference from kind of how you are on an everyday basis. Our neutral mood group did not get the bags of candy at the beginning. They're simply welcomed into the study and thanked for participating, but they didn't get any candy. And then during that that card task that I told you guys about, in the positive mood group, you might recall that I said that we put these little smiling suns around the experiment. In the neutral mood group, what we did is we took one of those smiling suns and we scrambled it on the computer. And it, in the end, it kind of looked like a moon with the same sort of colors as the sun. And we put those moons around the outside of the experiment in the exact same locations as the smiling suns were there for the positive mood group.
Great. And I assume that you didn't give them the candy while they were being tested. So
you know,
they didn't get a sugar rush.
No, great question again. That's actually a really important methodological detail because you're right, that kind of sugar rush can make a difference too. What we actually do at the very beginning with the positive mood group is you give them two bags of candy and a little thank you card, and you say to please put it aside for now, and you can eat it after the experiment if you'd like.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thanks for your questions.
Great. Thanks for the call, Jeff. 614-292-8513. It's Wellness Wednesday, and we're talking with Dr. Ellen Peters, an author of a recent study that found mood and decision-making processes were closely tied. You also tested for working memory. What exactly is working memory, and how does it affect decision-making?
So working memory is how much information you're able to remember in the moment. It's sort of... you know, just kind of how much stuff can you hold in your head at once and spit back out at somebody as something that you just remembered a moment ago. The actual task that we did is we would give people numbers and letters that are intermixed together, and then the participant was supposed to repeat back that group in numeric order and then in alphabetic order. So, for example, I would tell you that the combination of T9A3. And you're supposed to not only remember that, but you're supposed to put it in numeric order first and then alphabetic order when I ask you for it. So you'd repeat back to me 3-9-A-T. And that's an indicator of how much information you can hold in memory at once. And we give them a whole bunch of different groupings of letters and numbers like that. And the idea behind working memory and decision making is that oftentimes in decisions, you have to be able to remember something because you learned about multiple options. Let's say you were choosing between four different health insurance plans. And when it comes time to actually make the choice, you need to remember something about all of those plans. You need to remember maybe how much it costs, whether your own physician was taking part in that health insurance plan or not. There's kind of a whole bunch of information you have to remember in order to make the best decision in the end, so that people with higher working memory in these kinds of tasks where they originally know nothing and they have to learn about it over time, like with a health insurance plan, working memory helps. It helps you to better identify the best plans.
Mm-hmm. In closing, Dr. Ellen Peters, my last question, what was your favorite takeaway? What was your main takeaway from this study? What did you find most important?
To me, what I found most important was actually how you can help other people. I sort of started with this earlier, when someone's in a very important decision situation where they're not really sure what they're doing, you can actually give them a hand by just giving them a little gift.
Giving them a gift, and that will improve their decision-making ability.
Yep, exactly.
That's great. Dr. Ellen Peters is a professor of psychology at Ohio State University. She's also one of the authors of a new study that found mood and your decision-making ability were tied. Dr. Peters, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good one.
And when we return here on Wellness Wednesday, we'll talk health and fitness with New York Times columnist Gretchen Reynolds. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. And we're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
On the next Fresh Air. Chris Hayes, the former host of the MSNBC morning show Up, talks with us about moving from weekends to weeknights with his new show, how he learned to deal with conflict on TV, and how he approaches the discussions he moderates.
Simmer, not boil, which is our ideal space for a conversation.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us for All Sides tomorrow when guest host Steve Brown discusses the issue of the Supreme Court considering same-sex marriage. Hear from activists on both sides of the issue. And then what it means to be a rural community in 2013 and how to ensure their futures. That's tomorrow on All Sides from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. Clouds for this afternoon and a high of 43 degrees. Support comes from Bethel Dental Care, providing general dentistry from pediatrics to geriatrics in a comfortable atmosphere. A proud supporter and promoter of WOSU programming. More information at 614-451-0341 or online at BethelDentalCare.com. And support comes from the Council on Older Adults of Delaware County. It can help reduce the stress of caring for older relatives by providing tools and support needed to keep loved ones living safely and independently at home. More information is available by calling 740-363-6677 or online at growingolder.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann this week. It's been well documented that getting exercise can improve one's mental and physical health. But for those who really dislike exercise or who feel they're being forced into it, maybe the stress of having to work out outweighs those potential benefits. Joining us now to talk about stress, working out, and other fitness tips is Gretchen Reynolds. She's a health writer and columnist for the New York Times. Welcome back to the show, Gretchen.
Thanks very much for having me.
Listeners, if you have a fitness question or want to share what exercise routine is working out for you, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, that phone number, 614-292-8513. You can also email the show, allsides@wosu.org. You can post a note to our Facebook page, or you can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. Gretchen, this really is a daily struggle for me, so I can imagine it is for a lot of people. I get out of work early most afternoons is the perfect time to go to the gym when it's still pretty quiet there, but I hate it. I dread the thought of going. If I do make it to the gym, I usually end up feeling okay, and I lose the guilt that I would have later that night otherwise. But still, it's a stressful experience for me, and so, again, it has to be for a lot of people.
It is, and it's interesting. Scientists wondered whether the stress of being essentially forced to exercise, either because you felt guilty or because your spouse was bugging you about it, or because your doctor had told you you needed to, whether the that kind of stress would actually undo some of the mental health benefits that you otherwise get from exercise. It's very well established that for most people, working out makes them feel happier, makes them feel less anxious. But it wasn't clear whether that would be true for people who really hated exercise.
And it's a pretty common fear. It's a pretty common, thing.
Yeah, well, for most people who hate exercise, they just don't do it. But for people who do hate it and make themselves do it anyway, scientists wondered, would they still actually feel better and happier afterwards? So some scientists did a really interesting experiment with lab rats, in which they had the rats who, unlike most of us, actually do like to exercise, or they appear to. They like to be on running wheels and moving. And so the scientists gave some of their lab animals the ability to just run on running wheels whenever they wanted, at whatever speed they wanted, for as long as they wanted. And they took some other animals and made them run on running wheels that were preset, that they had no control over. Essentially, they were being made to run whether they wanted to at that moment or not. It's something that many of us are familiar with. I don't always want to go for a run either, but I make myself go every day.
Mm-hmm.
What they found was that the animals that were being essentially forced to run showed very similar changes in their levels of anxiety. They had less. And again, these are lab animals, so their version of anxiety and stress may be somewhat different than ours. But the results were very clear. The animals that were being forced to exercise still wound up being less anxious than animals that didn't exercise. So go out and make yourself run. It will almost certainly make you feel less stressed. It will improve your mood, and it certainly will improve your health, whether it's enjoyable
even,
or not.
even for the people who have anxiety about working out, you're saying it's still worth it.
Exactly. And in fact, it will almost certainly at some point reduce your anxiety about working out. And there is also some evidence that the more people do exercise, the more they start to enjoy it. So if you can stick with it, you will almost certainly begin to find it that it's less onerous than it might seem to be.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with New York Times columnist and health writer Gretchen Reynolds. Listeners, do you hate exercise? Does it stress you out? Did you used to hate it, but now you found a secret that maybe helped you enjoy the gym or helped you enjoy that trail run? Let us know. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, 614-292-8513. Email allsides@wosu.org. Post a note to the Facebook page or tweet at WOSU All Sides. Moving on to a new topic here, but still about stress. Today you wrote in your column about the value of getting outdoors. It's a big topic to kind of undertake, but there is a lot of value health-wise in getting outdoors.
Yes, and in fact, this builds on what we were just talking about, which is if you really dislike exercise, there's a growing body of evidence that you may find it more pleasant if you don't go to the gym, if you actually do it outside, if you go for a stroll in a leafy park. There's really good science suggesting that living in a city, living in a place where there's all sorts of things that we have to watch and pay attention to and worry about, saps our ability to focus on things. It actually takes all of our attention.
Sure, but there's so much going on.
Exactly, that there is, and you have to pay attention to that whether you're really aware of it or not. And our brain actually has a limited ability to focus on things. And when we walk down a city street, every bit of our focus is taken. That also seems to be true even in places like gyms where there's all sorts of motion and action and noise.
Right.
If you go for a walk in a city park where things are quieter, where there's greenery, where there's not as much activity, it appears that that actually fights what is known as brain fatigue. It allows your brain to reset itself and to start becoming able to focus better the rest of the time. It also makes you calmer. There's very good evidence, and I didn't write about this today, that people who exercise outside stick with their exercise programs better. And that's probably in part because they feel calmer afterwards. The sun is pleasant. All sorts of those things make it much more enjoyable to be outside. Even if you're just walking, you don't have to run. Even if you're standing under the trees, there's evidence that that improves mood, makes people happier.
And even just talking about it, even just saying the phrase, a walk in a stroll in the park almost makes you feel better, just thinking about it.
It certainly makes me more eager to get outside and do it.
You're absolutely right. We have Stephen calling from the Short North. Stephen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Ms. Reynolds, I read your book, The First 20 Minutes, and in a certain way it's changed my life. I've added sprinting to my hour-long exercise walk in the morning through the Ohio State University campus. And it has, changed my life in many ways. I know that just from the single sprint that I do in the morning, it takes about 30, on a good day, it's 37 seconds. At a bad day like today, where I was sort of pavement on the bridge, I did it in 43 seconds. I time myself every day. That's the result of my reading your book, too. too. I'd like to see improvement. But I appreciate your writing. I look for your column every day in the Times, and I want to thank you.
Stephen, thank you for your thoughts and story there. We had a bad phone connection, though. But is Stephen's story there typical? People who stick with things and who set common goals or daily goals, frequent goals, and they tend to stick with it and tend to do better?
Yes, and he also mentioned, I know it was difficult to hear, but there's really strong and compelling evidence that doing at least some of your exercise at a higher intensity, he was talking about intervals, and that means if you're going for a walk, speed up for 1 minute, slow down for another minute. That does seem to increase the benefits of exercise enormously. It also allows you to exercise less and still get the same benefits of going for, say, an hour walk. You can get those same health benefits in 15 minutes if you do part of that exercise at a higher intensity. And that doesn't mean all of it. It means you go hard for a brief period of time, you go easy mm-hmm. for a brief period of time. Just repeat that. And it's a very concentrated and surprisingly enjoyable way to work out because you get done quickly.
Right, and it's a strategy that a lot of professional athletes, a lot of really high-level athletes use to stay in shape. We do have another caller, Mary from Clintonville. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for the show. Good topic. I'm of the mindset that if you want to eat, you have to move. And I learned that a long time ago, and what really helped me understand that was my Fitness Pal. It's a free app on the iPhone. And using that every day, I've been able to lose 25 pounds just being cognizant of when I move, I burn calories and knowing how many calories I can actually eat every day. It just was a great tool for me, and I think it could be for a lot of people out there if they used it.
Yes. In fact, that's not just anecdotal. It's a very well-documented fact now that for many people, using some sort of electronic device, some sort of app, there are an enormous number of iPhone or Android apps that are related to tracking your movement throughout the day and at the same time tracking the number of calories you're taking in and the number of calories you're actually burning. And
yes, I had no
aware of that.
Many calories I was consuming.
Most of us don't.
Right.
And it's actually really helpful to have that tracked. A lot of us also don't realize how little we actually move throughout the day. Most
right.
of us, even those of us who exercise, then spend the entire rest of the day sitting. And if you just get up and walk around, you don't have to call it exercise. Get up and walk around your office. Walk once around your house. Those things all burn calories, and cumulatively, they burn a lot more calories than exercising for half an hour. So if you can find an app that will track how much you move and how much you eat, it can be a very successful way to lose weight and be healthier.
Well, Mary, thanks for the call. We have another caller, Timothy, calling from Whitehall. Timothy, good morning.
Yes, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. You're on the air.
Hey, this is a great show. Okay, Gretchen, I carry water, 4 gallons of water, 32 pounds. I can do for a couple hours a day walking. I'd like to know how many calories do I burn per hour, like 32 pounds?
You're asking the wrong person because I'm an English major and terrible at math, but I could guess that it would be a lot. If you are carrying that kind of weight and moving, if you're walking around, you are burning a lot of calories, a lot more calories than most people would. And I would bet that you could find an iPhone app that would tell you very accurately. It also depends on your weight and to some degree your age, how many calories you burn. So it is highly individualized. But if you're doing that every day, you're burning a lot of calories.
Yeah, Timothy, is that something you've been doing for quite a while and it has produced results for you?
Yeah, so I've been doing that for over a decade. I used to run. I'd be 60 years old, and I'm 6'5", 225 pounds. I used to run marathons, but I quit that a while ago because my height, I didn't want to tear my knee and stuff like that. So I I needed an alternative. So I said, well, you know, I need something to concentrate on. So I found out you pull, you know, carry 4 gallons of water and 32 pounds. And I do it 2 hours a day, 8 months of the year, because it's extremely hot and humid. I do about an hour and I'm on to myself. And I carry little balls of water with me. So I'm burning about 5 calories an hour.
Mm-hmm. Oh. And you never have to worry about being dehydrated. Timothy, thanks for the call. Gretchen Wilson, I do want to touch on your column that was very popular, a piece about arthritis, people with knee arthritis worried about how exercise might make it worse. It was a popular piece because these knee problems really do affect so many people.
They do. And in fact, it's one of the most common topics that we get at the New York Times when people send in questions is about why do my knees hurt? And the first thing I would say is, if you're worried about your knees, before you listen to any advice from me, go visit a doctor and make sure that you actually do have arthritis or that you don't have arthritis. Get an actual diagnosis. If you do have arthritis, the primary advice is you may need to change the kind of exercise that you do. Don't stop exercising, because there's really good evidence that moving is very important for maintaining as much of your knee health as possible. Running may not be the ideal exercise for you at that point, but swimming can be really good. Cycling can be very good.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, walking is fabulous. For others, it hurts. So the most important thing is move, keep your weight down. There is some evidence that if you don't have full-blown arthritis, doing knee squats can actually be protective of your knees. Doing squats, do them right. So if you don't know how, maybe look up a YouTube video that shows you how to do them correctly. Mm-hmm. If you have full-blown arthritis, your doctor may not want you to do that. So again, talk to a doctor or talk to a physical therapist. But do keep moving, because exercise is very important if you have sore knees. It's also hard.
And you talked to an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Michael Parks, who said he's seen little value in supplements that supposedly help rebuild cartilage.
Yes. Many, many people take glucosamine and chondroitin, which are marketed, of course, as rebuilding, essentially, cartilage. There's no evidence that's true. There's also no evidence they're harmful, and some people do say that after they've been taking them, their knees feel better. So if you want to try it, go ahead. It's probably a placebo effect, but a placebo effect still means your knees aren't hurting.
Right. Yeah, whatever it takes, I suppose. And you did the final options for people are injections of a lubricating type fluid, and then also surgery if that is a necessary option. Gretchen Reynolds from the New York Times, we are out of time, but thanks again so much for participating in Wellness Wednesday.
It's always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown. Be sure to join us tomorrow as we discuss the Supreme Court arguments on gay marriage. We'll be joined by activists from both sides of the issue. Also tomorrow, what it means to be a rural community in 2013. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.